29. "One at a time," Detective Poe said to the officer. Using a screwdriver on his keychain, the officer opened the first can of paint and poured the contents through the open manhole into the racing water below. From the light of his flashlight, Poe could see the purple paint mix with the water, then spread out. Placing the empty can to the side, the officer ripped open a second and repeated the process. At just that instant, Poe's cell phone rang and he stepped a few feet away and answered.
"Ling,"
Sung Ri said,
"I want you to come to headquarters. We've captured a suspect."
"Right, boss," Poe said. "The authorities have decided to trace the flow of water in the storm sewers with paint," Hanley said to Cabrillo. Cabrillo was wiping his wet face and hair with a hand towel. Once he was finished, he tossed it onto a table and ran a comb quickly through his hair. "If they did realize our men had escaped through the sewers, I was hoping that removing all the blueprints would slow down the pursuit long enough for our men to be extracted," he said. "Looks like we need to implement one of the backup plans." Hanley pointed to a computer screen. "As you know, the outflow pipe we picked for the exit into the bay is the only one on the southwest point of the southern peninsula. The outflow runs between the Nam Van Lakes and enters the water just north of the island of Taipa." Cabrillo stared at the computer screen. The image of the storm sewers looked like a crooked tree with sagging limbs. The sewer his team would use to exit was the trunk at the roots. "Have we been able to establish contact with them?" Cabrillo asked. "No luck with Hornsby, Meadows, and Jones," Hanley admitted. "The portable radios they carry just don't seem to have enough power to penetrate the layers of soil overhead." "What about Murph and Kasim?" "We've been trying," Hanley said. "But the voice transmission is spotty. Data seems to be passing through, however. We are in contact by alphanumeric signals." "So we can type orders to the Zodiacs and they can respond?" Cabrillo asked. "So far," Hanley said. Eric Stone interrupted the conversation. "Sirs," he said, pointing to a screen, "the portable camera Halpert left near the manhole is showing something you might want to watch." Cabrillo and Hanley watched as the officer poured paint into the hole. "Give me a simulation of how long that paint will take to reach our men," Cabrillo said quickly. Stone's hands danced over the keyboards, and a few seconds later, the screen showing the sewer system began slowly to take on a red color. The men stood watching as the color advanced along the arteries of the sewer system. A counter in the corner of the screen timed the movement. 17 minutes until the paint reaches where we believe the men are now," Stone said slowly. 22 until it reaches the water above Taipa." At just that instant, a printer off to the side whirled, and a sheet of paper was spit into the tray. Hanley walked over and picked it up. "The order just went through to the police boats and the two Chinese Navy boats here in Macau. They are supposed to begin patrols immediately to scan for the colored water. Then, when they find an outflow, remain there on station." "Start a timer," Cabrillo ordered quickly. "We're in crunch time now. Make sure everyone is aboard and prepare the Oregon to sail. I want my team out of that storm sewer with the Golden Buddha and safely back aboard. Then we need to vacate Macau by first light. With the Chinese Navy on patrol, this ship is in jeopardy."
"Broken Arrow?" Hanley asked.
"Confirm, Broken Arrow," Cabrillo said.
"Put it out, Mr. Stone," Hanley said.
Stone sounded the alarm. In a few minutes, the Oregon was a blur of activity. Tiny Gunderson was eating a salami sandwich and sipping on a glass of iced tea as he flew over the South China Sea. The brunette flight attendant, Rhonda Roselli, was sitting in the flight engineer's chair. The door to the cockpit was open, and the blonde co-pilot, Judy Michaels, walked inside and slid back into her seat. She was dressed in a khaki flight suit, and her face was freshly scrubbed.
"Tracy is changing and checking the equipment," she said.
"Did I tell you you did a great job?" Gunderson asked. "You both are the most convincing hoes."
"A master's degree in political science from Georgetown and 4 years with the National Security Council, and I'm sleeping with the enemy," Michaels said.
Gunderson popped the last of the sandwich in his mouth, then brushed the crumbs off his hands. Washing the last bite down with a sip of iced tea, he spoke.
"I think you forget I seduced a Romanian countess a few years ago," Gunderson said. "We do what we have to accomplish the objective."
"I remember, Chuck," Michaels said. "In fact, I seem to remember you rather enjoyed the assignment."
Gunderson smiled.
So you didn't like yours?
Michaels noted readings from the instrument panel on a clipboard.
The guy was a freak, she said. Capital P-H, freak.
Then it serves him right, Gunderson said as he unbuckled his seatbelt and slid from the pilot's seat, that we swiped his plane.
On the controls, Michael said.
I have to use the restroom, Gunderson said to Rosalie. Be right back.
In the dining room on the Oregon, Winston Spencer was sipping tea and worrying. Off to one side at a separate table, a guard sat on silent watch. Juan Cabrillo entered the dining room, walked over to Spencer, and handed him a slip of paper.
That's the account number of the bank in Paraguay, Cabrillo said. The transfer has taken place and the funds are available now. If the account is not accessed within 1 year of today, the funds will automatically bounce back to one of our banks. The second you make a deposit or withdrawal, however, within the next year the computer erases all traces of where the money came from or would go to.
Why 1 year? Spencer asked.
Because, Cabrillo said, in the financial shape you're in, if you don't touch the money in a year, it'll be because you're dead.
Spencer nodded. Next, Cabrillo handed Spencer a folder with a plane ticket.
Hong Kong to Dubai, then on to Paraguay, first class. It's the first available flight tomorrow morning.
Spencer took the ticket.
Here is $10,000 in U.S. currency, Cabrillo said, handing Spencer an envelope. Any more will arouse suspicions.
Spencer took the envelope.
That concludes our agreement, Mr. Spencer, Cabrillo said. We have called a cab to take you where you want to go. It'll be pulling up at the side of the ship in a few minutes.
The guard stood up and waited for Spencer to rise. Cabrillo started for the door.
Can I ask you a question? Spencer said.
Cabrillo had just opened the door. He stopped, turned, and nodded.
This all seems a little too perfect, Spencer said. What's the catch?
You still have to make it to Hong Kong, Cabrillo said, as he walked through the door.
On the Oregon's rear deck, George Adams waited as a landing pad on the fantail rose up to deck level. A hard rain was raking the deck, and the winds were a steady 20 knots from east to west. He turned to Tom Rise.
Once the deckhand locks the lift in place, we need to rotate the Whirlybird into the wind, he said. Then I'm going to need to make a hot takeoff into the wind.
Rise nodded and watched as another deckhand rolled a metal cart containing several boxes near the lift. The elevator operator signaled that the lift was locked, and Adams and Rise walked over. The Robinson R-44 helicopter was a medium-sized, piston-engine craft with a top speed of just over 130 miles an hour. The weight was 1,420 pounds, the horsepower of the power plant, 260, and the cost was about $300,000. The two men attached ground handling wheels, spun the ship around, then removed the wheels and handed them to the deckhand.
We distributed the dye into plastic baggies like you ordered, the deckhand noted.
Adams nodded and turned to Rise.
Keep the box at your feet, but away from the foot pedals. I'll take us down as low as we can safely go, but the ride'll be touchy because of the wind.
I understand, Rise said.
Adams did a quick walk around the helicopter, checking fuel oil and general condition, then motioned to Rise.
Hop in, he said, and we'll get this show on the road.
Once both men were in the seats, Adams reached down and ran through the pre-flight checklist. Once he was done, he screamed,
Clear!
Out the window and engaged the starter. Once the engine had fired and the clutch was engaged, the rotor blades started slowly spinning, then gathered speed until the helicopter was shaking and vibrating. Adams watched the gauges closely, and when the engine was warmed and everything had settled down, he spoke through the headset microphone to Rise.
Hold on, Tom, Adams said. This will be like a giant jump.
Neutralizing the cyclic, Adams quickly lifted the collective, and the tiny bird left the pad. A second later, Adams eased the cyclic forward, and the helicopter nosed over into the wind, rising and moving forward at the same time. Clear of the Oregon, Adams flew directly into the wind. Heading offshore a distance, he then started to angle back toward Macau. Around the knee of his flight suit was a strap with a metal clip, and in the clip was a folded slip of paper showing the locations of the storm sewer outflows.
There we go, Adams said, spotting the dirty water where a pipe spilled into the bay.
Rise reached down in the box, removed a baggie, slid the top open partway, and then tossed it out the small window opening in the passenger door.
It tumbled through the 10 feet from the helicopter to the water and began to spread out like blood from a rare steak. In the distance, a police boat heard the noise from the helicopter, but it could not make it out in the rain. Adams moved the helicopter up the line, salting the water on the east side of Macau. Then he steered around the end of the peninsula between Macau and Taipa to repeat the exercise. Detective Poe parked in front of the headquarters of the Macau Police Department, then walked through the rain toward the front doors. In the east, the sky was lightening some, but the rain continued on, unabated. Entering the building, he rode the elevator up to Ree's floor, then exited the elevator and walked down the hallway. Upon reaching the reception area, he instantly knew that there was trouble afoot. The U.S. consular agent, the mayor of Macau, a Chinese general, and 4 reporters were clustered around a man dressed entirely in black.
"This isn't a case of shoplifting," the man in black said loudly. "They've stolen a Boeing 737, for God's sake!"
It had been a case of blind luck for the software billionaire. Still refused a telephone call, he'd been brought to headquarters to be questioned by Ree in his office. As soon as they had entered the office, however, the billionaire had noticed a copy of Fortune magazine on Ree's side table. His face was gracing the cover. Once he'd pointed that out to Ree, things had begun happening fast. The billionaire had turned from suspect to victim in seconds. Poe walked over and stood next to Ree. Poe heard him whisper, "Damn," as the elevator door opened again and Stanley Ho started down the hall.
"Have you found my Buddha?" Ho said as soon as he was within range.
"Who the hell is this?" the billionaire asked.
"I'm Stanley Ho," Ho said in aggravation. "Who the hell are you?"
"Marcus Friday," the billionaire said loudly. "You might have heard of me?"
"And you of me," Ho said, affronted. "I'm one of Forbes's richest people."
"I know all the people ahead of me on the list. You aren't one of them," Friday retorted.
Detective Poe smiled to himself. If all this was true, it was the greatest game of one-upsmanship he'd ever seen. Here was a pair of obscenely rich men vying for attention like children trying to be picked for kickball.
"Yeah," Ho began to say. "Well, this is my town, and you can—"
"Mr. Ho," Detective Poe said quickly, "why don't you come down to my office so we can sort this out?"
"I'm not going anywhere," Ho said loudly.
"Everyone calm down," Ree said. He motioned to a conference room, pointed for the reporters to remain in the foyer, and then led the rest inside. Once everyone was inside and seated, he picked up the telephone, ordered tea to be delivered, then spoke.
"Okay, everyone," he said slowly. "Who wants to begin?"
Ho stared at the chief inspector.
"A Buddha I purchased for $200 million in Switzerland was stolen tonight while you were at a party at my house. I demand to know if you have recovered it yet."
"I lost $100 million in bearer bonds and my 737 to a gang of criminals," the billionaire said, "and want to know what is going on in this godforsaken country."
Poe stood up and paced for a second.
"Was your plane valued over $100 million? He asked Friday.
The billionaire shook his head.
"Then it looks like $200 million is the highest bidder here tonight," Poe said.